Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Arjun. This is going to be a really cordial interview.
This is Bernardo. Biggest mistake of my life.
This is Akash. I'm just happy to be here.
I'm leaving this in. Fuck it.
Yo, let me tell you, the key to auditioning, who cares?
I know, but that is the key. But I don't. That's.
Not, I don't know. I don't know.
This is a great intro.
Guys, we'd already done the intro. I thought. Anyways, what's up? Welcome to another episode of American Daisies. I'm Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
And I'm Bernardo.
Thanks, man. We appreciate you doing that for us.
Usually the guest just like quietly sits there while we do that, and I appreciate you diving.
Yeah.
Well, this is Bernardo Kubra, who is the newest associate member of Ammunition Theater Company, also a brilliant playwright and actor in his own right. He is a Mexican gentleman.
Yes, I am a Mexican. I am. I appreciate you saying that, actually. I am. I'm a Mexican man. Very proudly so.
Somehow Mexican gentleman sounds like you don't know him. Like, you don't know any Mexicans. Like, if a lady's like, he was a black gentleman, I'm like, you don't know any black people to be that formal about it.
Ma'am, who mugged you today? Oh, it was a Mexican gentleman. About 4'7".
So, Bernardo was the playwright of Judgment of Fools, which I've spoken about on this podcast.
I went to see. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks.
But we wanted to have you on this because I had in my head was very clever. The brown boys talk to the other brown.
It is, but they're very similar browns, guys.
I was just going to say that when you said 4'7", I was like, yo, both browns are very short.
No, our cultures are the exact same. They're so close. This is what my wife was talking about earlier. I think even our food is very similar. It's like meat in sauces, right? We both have arroz con leche, right? Like, what's that dessert you guys have that's like rice? What is that called?
Kulfi.
Yeah, that thing?
No, that's ice cream. Dahi.
No, dahi is just yogurt.
You're right. I'm an idiot.
No, kulfi. No, it's not kulfi.
Kulfi is ice cream.
Oh, this is horrible. I love it.
I don't love it. That's why I don't know the name.
It's rice, right?
It's like rice
with cinnamon and stuff. We have the exact same thing. At some point in the world, this kind of like the pyramid conspiracy, like you guys and we came up, well, like how people think that like the same people made the pyramids and how can they be in three different parts of the world.
Oh, right.
I don't believe this at all, but my dad, you get him drunk enough, he believes this. But my thing is that how did you guys make up that dessert and we have the exact same dessert?
I don't know.
And who invented it? No, I'm saying we're very similar people.
Yeah, my theory on that was always that poorer countries tend to, there's not as much you can work with. That's why it's always rice-based, bread-based. It's like starches that are going to fill you up. It's not like, hey, we need lean meats and veggies. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have access to that. So I think a lot of the dishes end up coming out the same. There's probably more to it than that. But
here's my question to just dive right in.
Great.
Was that, you know, talking about food, just Mexican food versus like other food. I was just in Cuba.
Yeah.
Mexican food versus Cuban food, dramatically different.
Very different.
So we talk about this a lot within like the Desi community, the South Asian community that's here. Mm-hmm. We're like, there's, you know, even though there are many, many diversity, like not diversities, many differences amongst like the region, you know, Pakistani was like religious differences, different South, North, South, like all the states, it's like so diverse. But when we come here, we're like, but we should be one.
Yes.
I feel like you guys, you know, within the Latino community in the States must experience something similar.
It's the exact same thing.
What I'm curious is that you guys have, in a community have been in the States longer.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that you guys have cracked that, you know, puzzle?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's interesting, like, even just generationally, right?
Okay.
Like, my dad believes that Latino encompasses, like, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Argentina,
really?
All the way to Mexico. And he's very proud of that. And it's actually when the World Cup happens, this is when Latino identity becomes very interesting, right?
Right.
Because during the World Cup, my dad roots for all the Latinos, right? So Italy, he's very proud all of a sudden. This Mexican man is like Italian, right? Right. Spain plays, he's like fucking, you know, Viva España, right?
Right,
then you go one generation down, and I'm like, fuck Spain. They raped the fucking Aztecs. They raped the Mayans. They created classism in Mexico, right?
Right.
Which is funny coming from a light-skinned Mexican dude who probably has like 1% Aztec in him, right?
Right?
But for me, I don't root for fucking Spain, right? And my dad and I fight about it. He's like, pero son Latinos. And I'm like, no, they're not fucking Latinos. Like, to me, a Latino is from Argentina to Mexico. Right. But even within that shit, we all hate each other, right? I mean, I'm sure it's the same thing in the, right?
Yeah.
Like for us, it's like... Like, I am very proud of being, it's always the tribalism, right? Like, how big is your tribe? Against white people, I feel like you try to get everybody.
Right.
So you're like, Argentine guy, you and me, we're together against them, right?
Right.
But then, in a street fight, Mexican's going to punch the Argentine guy first, because you don't like him. You know what I mean? Like,
well, see, actually, my sociology teacher made a great parallel, like, rooting for sports teams. The World Cup happens, you root for all of America. Then you go down to, I mean, it's a different sport, but NFL, you're not rooting for... All like America, you're in from my city. I don't like this guy from this other state in this other city. Then you go down to like the high school level. I don't even like guys within my city, the different high school, when we're rooting for that. It's weird how it's like a sociological thing that just happens.
So it's interesting. There's like a tiers to it. It's like it's more nuanced than like, that's interesting.
The tribalism goes down as you compete against other tribes.
Well, it just becomes smaller and smaller as you, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it depends on how big the fight is, right?
Right.
So if I have to take on all of the United States of America, that's a giant fight.
Right.
It's honestly just like being in a bar fight, right?
Right.
So if it's you against one guy,
have
I don't get involved.
Have you ever been in a bar fight?
Never. Look at me. That's like, you like my analogies? So it's like when you're at the gym pumping iron, you know, that thing I do all the time? No. So I'll only make analogies about things I have no life experience with. No, but I think it is about that, the size of the fight, right?
Right.
Like, And it's not even a fight, but just like when you're up against something. That's why Latino identity became a thing. But it's like, I mean, not to bring up the election like this quickly, but
do it.
One of the big problems with sort of the way that Democrats and Republicans try to get Latinos to vote is they treat us as this like...
As one.
Yes, this Latino
block. The Latino block.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, you're never going to get just Latinos to vote. The only way to get them to do that is if you say that they're all rapists.
Right.
You
so
know
Trump's
what I mean?
Like Trump's
so well, Trump's helping them, but the Democrats don't do a good job of understanding what a Latino voter is.
Well, but I know because many Cuban voters in Florida are incredibly Republican and don't want anything to do with Democrats and many but now they're I was just reading an article about how the Southern Floridians are and like the Cubans in Florida are facing quite the crisis because they're like, do we vote for Clinton?
Yeah.
Or do we vote, but we don't want to vote for Trump. And so they're just, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out.
But see, and that's another interesting like tribal Latino thing, right? Like I remember my dad is starring in this podcast, but he, you know, he would get like, you know, you get enough drinks in him and he would go on rants about how the fucking Cubans and their Republican voting patterns. And he would say it like that.
Right.
You know, it's like this true anger at like, you fucking sellouts because of your island, right?
Right.
Like you're not thinking about the greater good for the rest of us, right? Which is a very difficult thing to say.
So
to a
where
Cuban,
do you
right?
where do you land? Like, okay, first of all, then let me ask this: Do you feel like there is a cohesive Latino community? Do you feel like there is a Latin, or I guess, or can we not answer that because you have to answer it in more specifics? Like, is there a Latino community in the arts? Is there a Latino community like in like?
Well, I feel that there are enough cultural similarities. When I meet another Latino, I feel a instant kinship and bond with them.
Right.
Like if I go to an audition,
how often is that reciprocated?
I think often. It's very quickly, like, especially in the theater world in New York, which I was a part of for a long time, like, if the other guy's name is Javier, right? Like, I instantly know that I have something in common with Javier.
What
even
if
he's from Panama.
Of the theater world? When you were, like, if you were in a grocery store and you saw somebody that was Latino, would you in your heart feel something?
Yes, I feel at home.
Yeah.
It's almost like one of the reasons that in New York I liked living in, like, a neighborhood that was surrounded by, like, you know, Mexican bodegas, right? Like, I like,
right.
because I like being around my people. I like walking into a store and seeing, like, Salsa Valentina, right? Like, it makes me feel like, it's the tribalism, right? You feel safe. You feel like, I understand this.
Right.
You know? It's why if you go to a neighborhood where people don't look like you, which we should all do more of,
right?
Whether or not we admit it, you do feel, like, a sense of, like, this is not what I'm used to.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But, yeah.
You know, what's interesting about me is that I grew up feeling on the outside all the time, that I'm actually sometimes more comfortable as an outsider than
I am. Oh, that happens a lot with minorities.
Really?
And, yeah. And it can morph into mascotism, or it can morph into something. But now it's just an interesting thing where, like, I also enjoy the growth aspect that I get from it.
Sure.
But there is something that's, and I think I'm finding more balance where I can be more comfortable when I'm in, like, when I'm inside, if that's
whatever that means.
Right. But it just, I don't know, it was just an interesting point to.
No, I mean, so for me, the interesting thing is I went to an international school my whole life. From the age I was...
First of all, you were born in Houston.
I was born in Mexico City. Okay, but when I was two, I moved to Houston.
Okay.
Which that brings up a whole other thing about identity, right? Which we could get into. But from the age of 2 years old until I was 17, I went to an international school. And there was one American kid in my graduating class in Houston, Texas. And that actually, for me, makes it where I like being... It's, I feel safe in a mix. That's why I think I like New York, right?
Yeah. Right.
And I actually, because of that, I think my humor sometimes... Two very sensitive sort of liberals can be very, they like get very offended easily because when I went to that school, you just made fun of other people's differences.
Because it's not sensitive to you.
No, it's not even like bad, it's funny.
Yeah, that's like, I say that about the South all the time. It might be divided, but we're also just very comfortable with the fact that we're different.
Yeah.
And especially you going to international school, you have experience with it. So it's like, I have enough experience with this that I can make fun of it.
Totally.
And I get it. I don't feel this like, oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. I've been around enough that I'm a, like, the people I grew up with are, they allow me to say it, so whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just that I knew everyone I went to school with was not racist.
Yeah.
Or didn't look down on other cultures, because all we were taught was to love other cultures. And
but you also, but that was a very incubated environment.
Yes,
so
totally.
That, which is what allowed for that, which is where, like, when people... You know, make there are certain people that make fun of me or make that I'm totally okay with because I know the intention behind it is not. But if some random dude on the street, I'm going to experience that more differently.
Totally,
which is why I think is a little different.
It is
than
a tricky thing
to
navigate because to me, I can tell when it's, even if I don't know you, I can tell when you are saying something, making fun of me, and like it's ignorant and you don't have any experience with my people and you don't know what you're doing. And when you have experience with my people and you know enough about us to like, there's like a, I don't know.
Where's the difference between trying to connect with you because by making fun of you in some way, in like some perverse way.
And I also feel like it's, where it's like.
Or it's like, I'm trying to actually put you, be derogatory.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's that, but it's like, I almost get more offended when I know you have no experience with Indians and you're just like grasping at this joke and like, you gotta know a little more before you get in there. And I'm not gonna like hate you or whatever, but it's like, all right, well, you're trying and I get that and I'm not mad at you, but. You're not great at it. Whereas, like, Bernardo could say something about Indians, and I think I would just know, like, oh, this guy's comfortable with minority, comfortable with people that are different than him, and he can just go in, whatever. Even if, like, meeting you, I don't know you're...
Sure.
You're Mexican.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I guess everybody's line is different, and that's where it gets tricky.
But that's... Because I'm a fan of comedy, and you are a comedian, so... But I think it's interesting when people get mad at comedians that they know are not racist when they're exploring... difficult subjects like that, right? Like for me, if Louis C.K. is making like trying to make a joke
who is
about,
Mexican?
Yeah, who is actually? He's from Mexico.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's from Mexico. His dad was a redheaded Mexican, actually.
Yeah.
What is C.K.?
Well, I think it's actually it's like
how you spell his name is like S-E-I-K-E or something like that. But
he was like a Czech immigrant who went to Mexico or something, right?
Wow,
something like that.
Wild. That's an interesting
He lived
identity.
In Mexico.
Hey, Louis, come be on our show.
Yeah, you should be on your show. Yeah, give him a call. But anyway, the only reason I bring it up is like when I feel like, I mean, I'm obviously a liberal. Not obviously, but that's what I am. But I always think it's funny when they get mad at like someone like Louis C.K. for trying to come up with an N-word joke when you know that he's actually just trying to explore a very difficult territory, right? Like that to me, I'm totally cool with because I know who he is. I know what his intentions are.
My complaint recently, because I always rail on sensitivity because I want to explore this thing, is like you go to a comedy club. It says comedy club.
Yeah.
You know these are jokes. You take these seriously. You get offended. This is a real thing. I'm taking this seriously. Then you go home, put on a rap CD where they talk about hoes and drugs and murder. Yeah. Say it's all real. And then you're like, that's entertainment. That's what I'm looking for in my entertainment. This is just good old-fashioned entertainment.
Yeah.
That's where my new thing where I'm like, all right, let's let me explore.
I mean, I think that we can all agree that the sensitivities are... I think we're trying to find we're trying to navigate a new situation, and I think trying to be, we're trying to learn how to hold space for people better. I think that's a general, like, sort of pattern in the world. I think that we're doing a horrible job at it, but we are trying. We're toddlers at it. Yeah, I think the pendulum has swung, and it's this is my thing with change, right? For any change to happen, it starts in one extreme. The pendulum swings, and then you know it'll swing back, and hopefully swings back to bounce. But I think we're at the point where, and I think about it with masculinity a lot, you know, which where I'm going to use this as a parallel if I can, where we've gotten so much. Oh no, let me use it as this, like the whole winning thing, right?
Okay,
it used to be just like. What was it? Whatever kills you does what doesn't kill you make you stronger. Yeah. And now it's like, well, you can't ever be hurt because you need to get a like participation. That's the participation trophy kind of like like encompasses that idea. Yeah. And to me, it's like that's one extreme to the other. Hopefully, we can bring back to the middle. And I think that with sensitivity, we're finding that it's like if we're at university campuses right now where they're like limiting free speech.
Yes.
And creating echo chambers. And that's so dangerous. I mean, this will get me on my whole thing about diversity, but that's not really relevant to this moment.
Sure, sure.
So you were saying, though, that you grew up in... I don't know. Did you want to add something to that?
No. I mean, I agree 100% with what you said. Like, I am a middle ground guy. And I think it's important that, you know, that's what I'm a fan of. But what I was saying about the growing up, this has been an interesting thing recently about identity, right?
Right.
Is that people have now started saying to me whether or not I'm Mexican a lot.
Really?
More than ever happened to me. This is interesting. When I lived in Texas, and I would go into a store and speak to a guy in Spanish because he had brown skin, right? Let's be frank.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, that guy looks like a Jose. I'm going to talk to him, right? So I'd be like, ¿qué onda? They would never react weird. They would just be like, they'd just talk to me, right?
Right.
When I moved to New York and I would do it at a bodega, whenever I'd start speaking Spanish, I could see on their face, they were like, how the fuck does this gringo speak Spanish so well, right? But these were Mexicans, same people, right? Mm-hmm. And they're looking at me like, what? And very quickly, they're like, where are you from? And this is my thing. People can't see this, so I will explain because it's a radio show. I have a wallet that's a soccer team, that my favorite soccer team in Mexico. I've had this wallet since I was 12, right?
Amazing.
And so I would pull this out because I knew that if they saw this, they would legit believe me.
It's your flag.
Yes. But until I showed my flag, they would be like, they would just be like, nah, this is just a gringo who really took a lot of Spanish.
You think they were annoyed, like, stop trying to relate to me, white dudes?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that also brings up, like, sort of, I come from privilege in Mexico and what that experience is as opposed to someone who came to the U.S. for very different reasons, right? Like, my parents chose to come here. You know, they could have stayed in Mexico. It's a very different thing. So I think it brings up a lot of weight. But I bring that up because ever since I moved to York, then in, like, in theater situations.
In
New York and in L.A. still. It comes up a lot, like, well, are you really Mexican? And I get this from like other Mexican actors and stuff, right? Where they'll be like, or they're second generation people, and they're like, well, Bernardo, like,
are you Mexican enough?
You're not really Mexican, yeah? Which I'm sure you guys get that too.
A lot. Are you Indian enough? We've talked about that on here.
But we don't, they never phrase it that way. Because we're so identifiably, no one can ever come at me and be like, are you really Indian? It's like,
I didn't know you were Mexican until we sat down for dinner and had a real conversation. Otherwise, Bernardo, I don't put down as a Mexican. To me,
totally.
Bernard is just a super white name. I didn't think about throwing the O on there. I was like, all right.
Yeah. Well, if you ask my wife, because of this, I think I've developed this sort of, and for many reasons, but also the way my parents raised us. But I am like obsessed with letting people know that I'm Mexican. Cool. It's like this weird self-defense thing. It's deep in there. There's a lot of issues for it. But like, it comes up a lot in my conversations with people.
Right. The same thing with India.
Yeah, I mean, really? I talk about, you got to the point when I was on Nurse Jackie where I would talk about being brown so much that like much of the crew would be like, you gotta stop. They were like, what are you doing? Like, why you're making, it was purely a defense thing because I felt so outside and like, that was my form of mascotism, and I'm gonna be like, "All right, so if you know, if I don't know where to fit in, so I'm just gonna be the brown guy."
Yeah,
right.
You know, and that was what I was gonna be.
Mine was a defense mechanism for spending so many years being ashamed of being Indian, and then being ashamed of being ashamed. That it was like this overcorrection of like, I think it's evened out much more, but like constantly like. India this, India that. Now do it kind of like jokingly a little bit, but like it'd be ridiculous.
This podcast, actually doing this weekly, has really helped me be more comfortable with my Indianness and less and more nuanced with it in a way because I'm able to, well, because I'm afforded the opportunity to talk about it in a setting where we get to explore it really like quite deeply.
Yeah.
What is your response to, are other people receptive to when you talk about your being Mexican, when you bring that, like when you said this comes up in your conversations a lot, are people receptive to it, or is it kind of move around?
Yes, but I think it's interesting that we still live in a world where people tell you what you are. So, like, I want to live in a world where if I say I'm Mexican, like, yes, I grew up in the States. I moved here when I was 2. But my mom didn't want to move to the U.S., and she wanted to move back to Mexico. So she did everything she could to make sure we spoke Spanish at home. Mm-hmm. She would charge us $1 for every English word.
Wow.
And my dad made sure. Yeah, it actually was great, and that's why I speak Spanish, right? And then my dad, like, made us know very young that, like, you don't root for the U.S. teams. Like, fuck America, we root for Mexico, right?
So wait, why did they move?
Well, it was just for, like, well, my dad, I mean, if you go deep psychologically, my dad's father was a very powerful man in Mexico, and I think my dad, ultimately, I don't think he's ever said this to me, I think he left Mexico because he wanted to escape my grandfather's shadow.
Gotcha.
That's what I think, if you ask me, you know.
So it wasn't, so do you think there was a part of him that's, like, constantly missed Mexico?
Well, no, I think my dad was happy to be in the States because here I can be my own man.
Right.
And my grandfather's name is Jose Luis. His name is Jose Luis. So he was like, well, here I'm the only Jose Luis, right? Right. There's no shadow, right?
Right.
And but for my mom, she didn't want to be there. It took her, my mom, it took her until like 3 years ago did she say, okay, I don't want to move back to Mexico.
Wow.
Because of her family and she was sad about all that stuff. But anyway, so I grew up in a house where like, you're not American. And I was like taught, honestly, we talked about politics a lot in my house, like the US did some really shitty things, you know, like look at what Reagan did in Latin America. Like we were taught these things. And so I just have never been able to be like, I'm American, even though I know I am. Right. But if you ask me, Bernardo, do you identify as American? No, I'm not American. Mexican.
We all say the same thing.
Really? Yeah. I'm more comfortable not saying I'm Indian American. I'm more comfortable with like, yeah, of course I am because I've been acculturized. I think that's the word here. And like, I work here and I vote here and I'm there's a lot of things that are American about me, but using that word singularly, I can't do it. I have to add Indian to it.
Me too.
And I can't, but because to me, the word singularly still just holds space for whiteness.
Yeah, I guess for me too. And not even like, I guess to me, it's funny. I've been trying to write this play that is called The Slow Rise and Ridiculous Inevitable Fall of White People, right? Mm-hmm. And whenever...
Has it been a slow rise?
No. It's a jokey title, whatever. This play needs work, trust me. But one of the things... it does. It was like an idea I had in my head. I was like, that's hilarious. And then I started writing. I was like, this needs work. But one of the things is sort of this idea of whiteness, right? What you said, right? Because I have white skin, right?
Right.
Okay, like look at this. Right. I'm a white guy, right? So the idea of whiteness is hard for me, even though I know like there were professors in the 70s, like African-American studies professors that for them whiteness meant privilege, right? Or whatever that is. And that's a different conversation. But for me, I actually think the word that I can make sense of more is gringo. and what I mean by that is to me, like saying I'm American means I'm a gringo, if that makes sense. Yeah. Now I'm getting into really American. Fucking, yes. It
means you're a white American.
But it's like, to me, a gringo is like, sort of the imperial imperial America. Does that make sense? It's not necessarily about having white skin.
To you, it is about privilege. I mean, I would agree that for me, whiteness is about power structure. It's about the power structure.
You think it's weird for you to say it's about privilege because you come from privilege?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But you don't. But that's privilege in Mexico.
But it still might be like a thing. Like,
but you don't. But that's what's interesting. You come from privilege to now come be in a place where you don't have that privilege.
Well, that was interesting. I mean, I can tell this story, maybe. Can I tell this story? Something happened to me in Houston.
Why couldn't you tell
this? Sure. I don't know. But this is a podcast, right? You want me to talk, right?
Yeah. You know what? Actually, don't tell the story.
No, okay, you know what? Yeah, that's actually... Nobody wants to hear this story.
I'm legitimately just so confused by that moment.
I don't know. Why did I say that?
You guys, you can't see him, but he so earnestly looked at me with like, can I say this? Can I say this?
Yeah, I thought it was like family stuff.
I know. I don't know the story.
The insecurities are deep, people. You don't even know. But so, now what happened is, so speaking of like my privilege, like I come from privilege in Mexico, right?
Right.
The day it really hit me like that, oh yeah, I'm different here, was when I was 17 years old, I graduated from high school and I was breaking up with my high school sweetheart because I was going away to college and I wanted to date other women when I got there, okay? Right. So.
Where were you going to college?
In Mexico.
Oh, wow.
And so this is another part of the story.
Okay, great.
So I'm in this park in Houston, Texas at like 12:30 at night with my ex-girlfriend and she's crying and I'm breaking up with her. Yeah. And then this cop car pulls up. And in Houston, there was curfew at that time.
Yeah, I remember this.
Did you have it in Texas. Dallas?
Park curfew, yeah. I think they have it in New York too.
Park curfew. Parks just closed, is what you're saying.
Well, no, but after when you're 16, if you're not in the company of a person 18 or older in Houston, you have to be home after midnight. This is what it was. It was like a weird, wasn't it something like that? It was like curfew.
I don't know. Okay, so this was.
But it was a part of our lives. Right. I was only 17 at the time. Anyway, so I'm breaking up with her. This cop pulls up and he like pulls me aside and he's like, what's going on? I'm like, I'm breaking up with my girlfriend. He's like, totally cool, man. I get it. He's like, it's after 12:30. She's 16. You gotta take her home. I'm like, cool. He's like, where are you going to college, by the way? And I go, I'm going to school in Mexico. And he, like, the whole thing changed. And he goes, the whole thing changed. That's not English. That's, and the whole thing changed. No, changed. So, and he goes, why are you going to school in Mexico? I go, oh, well, I'm from Mexico. And he goes, hold on a second. And he goes to the cop car, and him and his guys start talking. I'm like, what the fuck is going on, right? And then he comes back, and he's like, we're going to have to search you. And I'm like, what? So he searches my pockets. I had cargo pants because they were cool back in the day. You guys remember those cargo pants? So I have khaki cargo pants on. And in one of the pockets, one of my best friends, he had chewable vitamin C's that I loved, okay, from GNC.
Okay. Love and those. So, orange flavor.
Yes, you remember?
My parents are selling GNCs.
Dude, they're the best. They call them GNCs? That's great.
No, they have them on the stores.
Oh, really?
Yeah, ironically, I was a very fat kid at the time. But we owned GNCs. Yeah, we had like four.
I can't picture you as a fat guy, actually.
Oh, buddy.
Really? You'll show me pictures
that
after.
That was gross.
No, so anyway, I had a Ziploc bag filled of these GNC chewable vitamins, right?
And they looked like pills.
They looked just like, you know, something.
Right.
And he goes, what is this? And I laugh. So I'm like, of course. And like, I'm like, you're not going to believe me, but these are vitamin C's. Like, you can try it. And he goes, we're used to your people having drugs on them. And I was like, and just my brain was like exploding. Anyway, long story short, I spent the rest of the night in the back of their cop car while my girlfriend's mom came and picked her up because they called her, took her home. That was the last time I saw her before I went to Mexico the next day. And then I sat in the back of this cop car till like 4 or 5 in the morning until they let me go. And then they just sent me home.
Did the girlfriend or girlfriend's mom say anything to the cops?
Did like, they not help you out at this?
No. So the mom, I remember the mom showed up. And she kind of gave me like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah. It was all like very surreal. And it was like, and then I remember they got in their minivan and they.
She didn't
I remember,
talk to the cops. That's how badly they took the breakup. They're like, keep going to jail. Forget it.
No, I'm going to tell you something. But this is, to me, that's an interesting, like, and I will never get, my mother, and I don't know if this was an authority thing or whatever for this particular human being, but I know that my mother and most people of color than I know, would never leave that situation.
Huh.
Would never not at least speak to the authority or speak to someone and be like, what's going on with this child?
Yeah.
He's someone that I am also responsible before because he's part of my community.
Yeah.
I'm going to check to make sure he's okay. I'm not just going to ask him, are you okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to say, hey, officers, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Let me find out. Why is this still happening? And because that's the way I was raised.
So you're saying that she has this innate trust in what the cops are doing, so she just thinks it's past curfew.
No, I'm talking about the sense of community.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm talking about our responsibilities to community and the way that we, like...
I think culturally we're raised with much more responsibility to others.
Yeah.
Maybe that's...
And I think that that's a family thing. I think that
totally.
Like, it's like a, hey, we're... No, it's like, and what family, and however you turn, like, whatever you define as family...
Yeah.
Becomes community. So anyway, sorry, that's just something.
No, that's it.
Because that's crazy that she just asked you if you were okay.
Yeah,
you said
talking.
Yes. You were 16. You were 17.
Yeah.
You're a kid. I'm an adult.
Being searched by the cops.
Like the cops. Like, how are you okay?
Did you say to her like, I told them?
No, I was in complete shock.
You probably said, yeah.
I mean,
I'm okay
in my memory of it, I just like, I also, I think I didn't realize what was happening. Like, it kept happening.
It is very surreal the first time.
Yeah, and every time something kind of weirdly, you know, because that's the thing, like, that's the most dangerous kind of racism, right? Like, in Texas, if you're called a beaner, right? Like, that's, I totally get it. Like, you don't like Mexicans. Like, it's easy to get, right? So I'm out. Like, I don't need to engage. But this kind of thing is just like a slow burn of racism, right? That you're like, oh, and little by little, your brain's like.
It stays with you.
Yeah, and at that point in my life, I'd never had, like, something this blatant. So I just kept thinking, like, no way this is happening. Wait, this is happening?
This is surreal.
Oh, this is happening. Oh, I'm still in this car.
You know? This is sick. I had a gun pulled on me in my neighborhood, it was a very nice neighborhood. We were, like, upper middle class for sure.
Yeah.
And Or like, yeah, I would say that that's a fair assessment. And we got, but I just remember it was a kid that was on like a mini dirt bike, and we, my friends and I were playing football on the driveway, and he like went by, and one of my idiot friends was just like yelling at him or like making fun of him. So he came back and he started like really fronting at us, and I was sitting there, I was like, this is ridiculous. So and he drove off, and so then he came back with a gun, and I just stood there and I was like, it just didn't make sense. Yeah. It didn't compute that in this neighborhood that this kid that I was experiencing gun being pulled. So I literally, all I said to him, I was like, you could get in a lot of trouble for this. I legit, those were the words that came out of my mouth.
Buddy, I wouldn't shoot that.
You could get in a lot of trouble for this, you know? Pointed at the, it was like an air gun or something. But regardless, it was a surreal experience. And I don't mean to shame this woman. I don't mean to shame. It's an interesting observation.
I don't think she'll listen to this podcast.
It's an interesting comment around community. But
totally.
So continue though. I interrupted.
No, that's it. So that's the story. But that was like, so.
No, what happened? How did they end up letting you go?
So at like 4 o'clock, they're like, okay, or five. I honestly don't remember what time it was. It was very late, and they say, go home, you know, you can leave now, right? And so I just get in my car, and I was, like, shaking. And I drive home, and I'm, like, really shaking. I walk in, and my mom's freaking out.
Right.
Because my mom knows that I'm breaking up with my girlfriend, and I haven't called her. So she's just worried. She's like, you leave at, like, I don't remember what time my flight was, but you leave tomorrow. What the fuck are you doing? And I'm like, and I get in, and I tell my mom, I just start crying. Like, it was like, shock, 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 shock. Then you see your mommy, and my mommy's amazing, so I just started fucking crying. And she, like, helped me. And it was pretty cool because my mom was a teacher at our school. And this guy who was a city councilman, Orlando Rios, I think was the guy's name. Mm-hmm. Orlando Sanchez was the guy's name. He was a Republican. But anyway, my mom taught his kids. And so my mom, at that hour, was like, beep, 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 beep. Orlando Sanchez, I think was his name. And then called and left him a message and told him the whole thing. And, like, supposedly he, like, you know, made shit happen to get these guys in trouble or whatever.
Really?
But... yeah, it was just like a moment of like...
How do you think that what do you think that meant to you, and what do you think that still means to you?
Well, it lets me know that I'm different, right? Kind of like every audition always reminds me that I'm different, right? Yeah. Like you always think... I think up until that moment, I thought we were all kind of kumbaya.
Let's unpack the word different, though. Like, what is
that? That I'm not one of the majority of this country. I mean, that's changed, right? But that I'm not part of the power, the people in power in this country, right? That's what I think it taught me. And until that point in my life, it said, like, you got it pretty good, bro. You know? Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I was like, oh, yeah.
Maybe a huge shock.
Sure. It's
a
like...
huge an adjustment of thinking. But I will say this too often, and I agree. And I'm someone that often is very clear, like, I'm not in the power structure of this country. Yeah. But that I think too often... we as minorities and people, marginalized communities, however, whatever term speaks to you at this moment, we let that take our power away.
Yes.
And I wish I had more profound place to go with that.
We talked about this.
But that is, to me, a problem. That we may not be a part of the power structure, but that doesn't mean that we don't have immense power.
Yes.
Well, I've talked about this. I think... and people don't like this opinion from me, but I think those moments are important for us to understand that we're different. Now, you have to come out to the other side where you say, all right, I'm different, and that's beautiful, and I'm from, and get your power back. Yeah, right. But I think those moments, because until then, you didn't know you were different. And this is also probably a cause for resentment from some Mexicans, is that, and that's probably why Mexicans will quickly be like, you're not Mexican.
Yeah.
Because people don't look at you and say, you're Mexican. Mm-hmm. It's not until they hear your last name or you say I'm Mexican, then they treat you differently.
Yes.
But until then, and I think that's why a lot of times light-skinned people are more militant, because our own people elevate us.
Yeah.
Usually the discrimination we get is when someone see, like, when a white person is like, oh, here's an Indian, or finds out, hey, here's a Mexican.
Yeah.
And then they're racist to us, and they're like, all right, you know what? I don't need y'all. My people love me.
Yeah.
My people are the best.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of dark-skinned people, I think, tend to... be more comfortable with white people, because our people will like be like, yeah, you're inferior.
Huh.
And then, but that's just that's a thing I've noticed. But the I have a white friend. Sorry to keep going, but I have a white friend, Andrew Schultz. But he's a good point. He's like, look, you kind of are what people treat you like. Like everybody, comics had this big controversy that Carlos Mencia was like half Hungarian or German or something. Like he's not fully he's not Mexican at all. He's like Honduran and something else. But he's like, yeah, but people always treated him as a Mexican.
Yeah.
So he's Mexican for all intents and purposes. Yeah. He took the racism of a Mexican. he is what you are, what people treat you like.
Yeah. And see, for me, like, I'm not a Mencia fan, right? Like, his art I don't like. But as a person, if he wants to identify as Mexican, then that's my point. Like, if that's his experience and he's not doing it to gain career followers and stuff, then I'm totally cool with it if that's how he feels.
We should put a caveat because then it brings up, like, the whole Iggy Azalea sort of situation.
Sure.
And, like, when... Because I actually don't know her background, so I'm going to look to you because well, you know pop culture.
The difference is you look at Carlos Mencia and see a Mexican. People did. So they treated him as a Mexican.
Yes.
No one looked at Iggy Azalea and saw a black person.
Well, is she black?
She's completely white. I mean, look at her.
She is completely white. I didn't know if that
made I honestly know nothing about Iggy Azalea, but except Iggy Azalea, that she's dating Nick Young, right? The basketball player?
Yeah. She's a rapper.
Yeah.
Or a pop star. No, barely. Sure. But I just know there's conversation because a lot of black rap artists.
Well, I mean, she's pale, like pale white
girl. But so is Blake Griffin, but he's black.
Yeah, but he's at least half black. We have no evidence that Iggy Azalea is at all.
So she, using the form and using the culture of hip hop, they often talk about like she identifies as black, but like, can she? That becomes ultimately the question.
Well, that's the question, right? But like,
but you're saying that she can't.
Well, I don't mind if she. This is what I'm saying. Because it's complicated. And I'm still honestly, like, every day learning what I think about this stuff, right?
Of course.
But I think that if she wants to use that art form to express herself, she's well within her right. Now, if in an interview someone says, what are you? And she says, I'm black. That's very different than saying I'm Mexican for me. Because that's just like, what are you, right? Like, I don't walk around saying, like, I am an Aztec, right? Or I am a mestizo or whatever word, right? Like, I don't walk around pretending that I have dark skin, right? So for her to say black, that's a different thing because she's just not black. Like, it's just like a scientific, you see it. But could she say I'm an Australian or wherever she's from who really identifies with black culture and I really love it and that's the language that I choose to express my point of view? Yes, I think she can say that.
Well, yeah, I think if she used that language, I don't think there'd be as much controversy.
But she's not going to use that language,
I don't think that fits in a tweet.
I also still don't think people would really care.
I think people, if she expressed it that way, I think that, because it's taking ownership, it takes self-awareness. I think people are much more responsive to things that are coming from a place of self-awareness, which the steroid conversation around baseball was really stunning to me. How quickly Andy Pettit has been forgiven.
Yeah.
And how like how much animosity there is towards Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and all of this stuff. Where I really think that if Barry Bonds or Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa, any of those guys simply owned up and said from a place of self-awareness, like, this is what I did, I really think people would just be like, cool. Because I think as humans, we are much more compassionate and much more much better and much more compassionate than we give each other credit to be.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons I like comedians. Because I think what a comic does, or a clown does, is he is never not self-aware. The clown always knows that I am insecure, I am uncomfortable.
You being the audience.
No, as the performer. A great clown says to you, right? Like, Richard Pryor never said, I'm the best fucking comic of all time. He's like, I have a lot of fucking issues, right? And that sort of, like, comfort and that sort of... You know, I'm just saying the same thing you are, but I love that in people. I always say, like Lauren says, like, what do you look for in a guy friend, right? I always say self-deprecation. Me? Yeah, RJ. Yeah. No, but self-deprecation.
What do you look for in a guy friend?
She does. Is she asked me that.
Woman question possible. What do you look for in a guy friend?
Yeah.
Who looks for anything?
Yeah. Well, I do.
I like someone or I don't.
Right, self-deprecation.
We can compartmentalize stuff way easier. It's just like, we just throw in a door and we don't think about it.
Totally. But if I meet a guy and in the first 3 hours I'm hanging out with this potential guy friend, right?
Yeah.
And they're not able to make one joke about themselves, or if I make a self-deprecating joke and they take it weirdly, I'm like, I can't be your friend.
Right.
Like, we have to be able to joke about who we are and how weird this moment is as two people trying to connect.
Right.
So that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, can we talk about Lauren a little bit?
Yeah, of course we can talk about Lauren.
I actually don't know this, so I'm asking you, where is Lauren from?
So Lauren is, well, this is interesting about identity. Lauren's Jewish, right?
Right.
I think
but
there's
Jewish
a lot
from?
Of, well, she's from the United States of America. She's from San Francisco. But her family's New York.
That is the whitest place.
Yeah.
A lot of Asians I know, but still a very white place.
It is. And she comes from a very place of privilege, and it was a very nice upbringing that she had, right? But this is an interesting thing I think about, and I'm not going to pretend to dive into this, but I think that the Jews are the largest minority in the world, right?
Are they?
Yes, without a doubt.
What do you mean they're the largest?
In numbers?
Yeah.
The Jews are like 2% of the world's population.
No.
Yes.
Look up numbers. It's shocking how few Jews there are.
No, not that's in the what I'm States. Saying. Not in the States.
Oh, but that's exactly what I'm saying. Maybe I'm not expressing this right.
You're saying they are the smallest in numbers.
Yes, that's what I mean. Right. Biggest, if small is the best, they're the best.
They're the smallest.
Let's just how many languages do you speak? First of all, no, I'm just kidding. No, but yes. So
three. How many do you speak?
Three.
Oh.
There are fewer Jews than almost every minority.
That's what I'm saying.
It's shocking how few Jews there are.
Yes, but when you talk to a lot of minorities, I'll say this. When I started dating Lauren, I was like, oh shit, anti-Semitism is fucking real, bro.
Yeah.
And what I'll say about that is when you talk to other minorities about Jews who are the largest minority, or however you guys want me to phrase that, right?
The smallest minority.
Like, they think of them as just white. They think of them as part of the white thing because a lot of them may be successful or whatever that means. But I'm like, no. Like, they have a very real struggle.
Well, here's what's interesting. I used to talk about this on stage when I would, especially at the comedy club I came up in, a lot of times there would just be like five people at the show.
Yeah.
So you can't do jokes like it's a full room. It'd be weird. So you talk to people. Every time I talk to a Jewish person, I'd say, how do you identify? Do you identify as white or as a minority? Every single time I said, I identify as white. And I'd say, what's hilarious about that is white people hate you. White people never include you as white. But also, minorities only think of you as white. They're in a weird place where it's like, white people are like, no, we don't want them. And we're like, well, they're you.
Yes.
They look like you. And it's the same thing. You are what people treat you as. So like, you're white. Go ahead.
But isn't that fascinating? I'm fascinated by that, right? And the idea that being Jewish is not just a religion.
The Jew is fascinating.
Bernardo Cubria. I'll tweet that later. You can retweet me at Bernardo Cubria, where I just ponder things about the Jews. No, I married a Jew, so I'm allowed to say these things. No, I'm not actually. No, but I just find that interesting that other minorities don't like. Yeah, it's just interesting to me.
I'm telling you, it's a fascinating place to be in the world because you look at them and especially being a minority as small as they are.
Yeah.
As minor as they are in your terms, but like hold a lot of power. And I actually think they're a model minority in the sense that there's a lot of solidarity between them. And that's like, this is what we could do.
I agree with that majorly. Well, this is funny. Lauren always says like, you're obsessed with your identity. And she doesn't mean that that's a bad thing, but she's like, she cares deeply about it. But like Lauren would not, like in a program, I always write Mexican playwright, right?
Right.
It's very important to me that everyone know, right?
Right.
Lauren, if she was in a program, she's a documentary film editor, but she would never put like Jewish editor Lauren Saffa, right?
Right.
Even though she's very proud of being
Jewish.
Well,
the Jewish is also implied in this business. You know what I mean? Like,
so they know. No, that's true. That's fair. That's totally fair.
I had an issue. I dated two Jewish girls back in relationships, and shouts to Sarah and Jen, who are absolutely not listening to this podcast at this moment.
If they were, that'd be weird.
Yeah. But both of their fathers, I got close with their fathers, and both of them were like, you know, Jews and the Indians are basically the same.
Yeah.
We have the same thing.
We are very similar.
I started our conversation.
Yeah, so I mean, but I don't think, are you getting that a lot from, you know, your father-in-law? That we're basically the same?
No, but he's not very, he's like a Buddhist now, and he's very San Francisco.
I'm also curious to know if they would say that, because South Asians have a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't know if they would say that to a minority we tend to consider poorer, like generally speaking.
Well, I think
would
he that's be very like, interesting.
You know, the Jews and the Mexicans are the same. You know what I mean? You guys for construction, we own banks.
Well, let me ask you this about your marriage. You, as someone who is so proudly Mexican,
sure,
and coming up in the house that you did,
yes,
and that obviously was incredibly important to you. Was there part of your life where you were like, I have to marry a Mexican? Was there a part of your life where like that was huge? And then what was the shift? Because obviously you didn't.
Well, I think going to international school made it so that I liked all kinds of women, right? I mean, I think we've liked all kinds of women, yes.
Growing up, becoming a man, like all kinds
of women.
No, but also you do tend to like who you grew up with. That tends to be your, like, what you tend to like more.
Huh, okay.
He grew up with everyone.
All right, fair,
tends
fair.
To like everyone.
Yeah, and I also like people with international understanding, and Lauren is that. Right. And Lauren, one thing that, like, when we first met, she speaks Spanish fluently. And that obviously was a huge turn on for me. I was like, we can raise children together. You know what I mean? Like, because I want to speak to my children in Spanish like my mom did. And with Lauren, I am afforded that possibility. And she lived in Cuba. She lived in Argentina. She's been all over Asia. Like, those were the things that turned me on about her. Mostly that she's incredibly intelligent. And then the other thing was that, like, she has traveled the world, and so she's interested in the world.
You found cultural compatibility even though she was not of the exact same ethnicity as you.
Yeah, I found that she is someone who is curious about why people do things differently in other parts of the world and learning from that and making herself a better person.
Right.
You know, which is what I look for in... It's another thing I look for in a guy friend. No, but you know what
Guys that are listening to our podcast, Bernard.
You can tweet me at...
Well, I want we don't have a ton of time left, so I wanted to pivot to this, and it's somewhat foolhardy to do it with such a little time left.
Okay.
But something that Akash has always talked about, and I'm surprised you didn't bring it up.
You know,
Latinos are the only real. What do you in our industry?
We always talk about being represented properly.
Okay.
In film, whatever, and then I'm like, all right, well, let's look at numbers.
Okay.
South Asians are overrepresented. According to population, we are, I think, 1% of the American population, less than 1%.
This is
only 1%?
Wait, this is, yes, but this is an argument that I 100% disagree with.
Okay, great. Sure, I'm interested in this.
As you should. We want money. Like, of course, we want work. We should. Okay. We shouldn't talk about this openly.
That's not why I disagree with this.
Keep thinking that. But the point is, Latinos are the one minority that is truly, severely underrepresented in American, particularly mainstream American film and television.
Sure.
And that's a thing you could speak to. Whereas I think everybody else is like, I talk to some of my black friends. I'm not saying all, but the ones, my black friends legitimately seem to think they're 50% of the population and they should be 50% of mainstream, whatever. And then I'm like, all right, well, what about Indians? Like, who cares? And I'm like, all right,
I like where you're going with this. I may not agree, but I like the brain, because what you're saying is like, ratio and numbers, right?
Yeah.
So like, let's
a realistic depiction of America. That's what we always talk about.
Yes. So then what's the percentage?
You are severely underrepresented.
No, I don't want... wait. I think that's a really... It's not about a realistic... I want to represent the population in a more egalitarian way. Which means that because media's influence is not to... Because that's, again... influence that's coming from an idea that because you're white, you therefore have 70%, you get 70% of the pie, just you individually, because you're white. That is a mentality that allows for the privilege. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. But what I'm also saying, think I, know, I still I'm, feel my point.
No, I'm not. Look, feel your
I
point.
I also
not,
think if I'm understanding, I'm like, yeah. I also think I'm like, yeah, of course.
But why? Okay.
Because to represent everyone is exhausting.
Sure, but there's 700 television shows. Netflix is just investing $6 billion in content for 1 year.
So we need a Hungarian television show. Why not?
But why not?
Swiss television show. Because no one cares. Because you still need enough numbers to keep it going.
And you keep thinking about it ethnographically, where I'm thinking about it like, what images of these people are we presenting? Sure. Even if there's only 1% South Asians in this country, that doesn't mean my humanity only has 5 images. That doesn't mean that I only get 1 character to represent all of my people. That's crazy to me, because humanity doesn't have, like, our commonalities of humanity is that we are expansive as people. Just because you're Latino doesn't mean you are a certain thing. I think that's like the baseline we understand. So how, I don't understand how you like bring this empiricism into an artistic frame. I don't get it.
Because that's the argument that's usually presented. I just want to be represented fairly in numbers.
That is what people say. No, I understand where you're coming from.
But it's not based on a demographic. Like, because I'm 3% of the population, I deserve to be 3% of the leads. It's to say that, like, I am here. You must see me because I am here, period. And to be here means that I'm not just here in a token way. I'm not just here. So if you take a movie down and because I'm black, that means I only get what, or because I'm South Asian, let's do that. I only get 1% of the movie that I get to be in. Is like, where do you, like, this doesn't make it. I am here. I am me. I am you.
But
you
then
must
this
see
is what's interesting is we talked about this. Do you want it to just be a meritocracy? Because then you could just say, look, these are the shows that make the most money. This is what the business model, and it could be shifting, but historically the business model has been successful this way. So this is how we cast it.
Create a bit meritocracy in this industry. Go ahead, and I would love to. I would support it 100%. Build that meritocracy. What are the qualifications? What are the criteria? Build it. I support it.
If you just say we cast, however, we like this guy the best, go.
But that's not a meritocracy. Because liking someone the best is not based on merit. It's based on subjective appeal.
That's still merit. Not. Yeah, it is. No, if I have the money and I produce the show, that's still merit. What's interesting is you asked to talk to Bernardo about it and you keep talking. That's what's fascinating to me. I would love to sift through that a little bit.
Well, that's you got to get like, a couch.
Hey, you have an interesting conversation with Bernardo to have, you don't even look at the man the whole time we're talking.
And I'm sorry,
bring this couch over here. We can analyze that.
This is an argument we've had a number of times. I got passionate.
Please. I love it. I think it's great. I mean, I think you're both right, to be totally honest. I think that we're underrepresented? Yes. Do I think that the powers that be still have a very intentionally and unintentionally racist way of thinking what we want? Yes. Like when you see the Latino shows, quote unquote, that are being made and created, there is a certain white understanding of what a Latino wants that I think is one of the mistakes of why we are not getting the shows on
television. Have you ever seen it done right?
I don't watch TV, so because my wife is an editor and the last thing she wants to do at night is watch television. So we watch very little television. But I think like while Jane the Virgin may not be something I enjoy, I think that a lot of what they're doing is really great and important because it's trying to make the Latino story seem just like any other story, right? Which is the thing I'm very interested in, right?
How so?
Well, I'm not interested in...
How do they
I mean, look, Latinos? I would have loved to have been on the show because I want to be on a television show, right? But like for me, the idea of the show telenovela is the wrong way to go. Because what it's saying is Latinos like telenovelas, and so the only way that we can get them on television is by like...
Giving it a telenovela.
Taking this Latino trope, this form, right, and putting it in English and putting it in this sort of like... office space comedy, and then trying to mix those worlds, right? I respect the effort that Eva Longoria did, but I think it's wrong.
I think what he's saying is that I appreciate projects where I happen to be Latino. It's about a person who happens to be Latino. The story is not inherently around their Latin identity. For example, Fresh Off the Boat or Blackish, entirely around the identity.
Which I personally like.
I know. But which there's a very strong argument to it, but I do want to ask this about what do you think needs to happen?
I think that there need to trust. I believe this in art in any way. Trust the artist, right? The best shows ever were there was one person's opinion, and they said, hey, I'm David Simon. I have this idea about The Wire. And HBO didn't fuck with him. They didn't get in his way. And they allowed the artist to make his art, right?
Right.
And I think what happens is a lot of really great Latino writers that are out there, because I know them, they're all playwrights, right? Like Tanya Serracho, Mondo Alvarado, Charisse Castro-Smith. Like, these are amazing
None players. Of these people are listening to
No, I know they're not. But whatever. These are really great playwrights. They try to write certain things for television. And then they're given notes by people who are not from our world. And they're told, like, no, for America to like this, you need to change into this. And I think they're wrong. I think trust the artists. These people are Americans. They have had American experiences.
This is why I think we need to get more people of color and minorities in positions of power.
Yes, well, of course.
To that point, actually, to both of your points, I've noticed with a lot of shows I've worked behind the scenes, all these notes are just people trying not to get fired.
Yes.
Was it you that told me the line about L.A.? Everybody's in a...
I met with an agent who said this about L.A., but I actually think it applies to the entire industry. He just didn't want to admit it because he lives in New York, and you know we have a real air superiority about it.
Yeah.
This whole... He said L.A., but it's the whole industry is in a big race to come in second.
Yes.
No one wants to take the risk of coming in first and being the first show to do this because that has a high risk of flaming out, crashing and burning.
Totally.
You lose a job. So let's find... let's find the next broad city... Which I also think is like weirdly, I find that a little racist.
Yeah.
Because no one's like, let's find the next Wildin' Out whose numbers are probably better.
Yeah.
But it's like a young black thing, and we don't think advertisers will pay for it, whatever.
Yeah.
But let's find the next that thing.
Yes. Well, that's what everybody's doing, right? But I think that's a mistake. In art, you have to allow the artist to take a risk and fail, right? I mean, honestly, this is not like kissing the ass of Ammunition Theater Company, but I thought it was insane that they chose, not that I'm like saying, but like my play was very risky. It's like, and I knew it. It's like a crazy thing to like.
But that's why when I started the company for that. I mean, that's what I and the company will evolve as it is because it's not entirely up to me. You know, I mean, we're democratic and it's bigger than me. But one of my jobs is to say to confront this is that I don't want to operate from a place of fear. I want to court failure as an artist and as a person. And I think that
where it's tougher. I'm sorry to play devil's advocate.
When there's money.
Yeah, it's not just money. This is Ammunition Theater is like it's not really income for you. Like you have other sources of income that pay way more. You are fine financially if Ammunition Theater doesn't work out. For these guys who are taking these risks, it is their families on the line. And not just we're putting it in a minority's hands. I'm putting my life in someone else's hands and say, hey, I trust this guy with my family, essentially.
But that's how you stay average, right? It's the blackjack analogy, which I love, right? Like, if you go play blackjack, even if you count cards, if all you do is bet $10 every single hand, you're never going to make any money. Even if you're the greatest card counter in the world, if all you're doing is betting 10. At some point, even if you can count cards and you know I have an 80% chance of getting a 10 right now, you have to bet $100 instead of 10. And that's the only way you win. And I think in art, you have to do that.
The mistake we make is separating, in TV, the show from the business. This is not a bunch of people trying to make art necessarily.
Sure.
A lot of times, and I don't, when you think about it in their position, you can't really judge them. It's guys trying to feed their families.
No, but this is where I disagree with, though, for example, because if we take the blackjack analogy into the studio, TV studio situation, you have all of your shows are your bets, right? You have your slots available to us.
Yeah.
So if you're betting, he's not saying you bet 100 on every single
hand. No.
Hand. He's saying that that there are some of those hands you have to bet 100.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that.
But also,
look, I'm not living in a world where I believe that reality TV will disappear. As much as I would love all networks to take all those hours of programming that are dedicated to reality TV, which are most networks, a majority of it, and place that in scripted content. I'm not advocating for that. That's not reality. It's not realistic. But within the 10 hours of scripted shows that they are going to program and that they are going to place on the air, why can't two of them be a risk?
Because think of how much it costs to make a show.
Please, these guys they're not at want for money, and one risk is not going to be the thing that...
Oh, they are at want for money. This whole TV model has shifted to the point that no one knows what's going on.
Netflix just put in $6 billion.
Netflix is not at want for money. Netflix is the one that's making all these other networks.
But the way that Netflix got there was by taking risks. That's the crazy thing about it. The way that HBO got better than television was that HBO took risks.
They're also fortunate in that ABC, NBC, CBS... don't get $10 per subscription. This is completely, you put out good content, you will get our $10 a month. This is an optional thing. ABC doesn't have that. They don't get to charge cable $10 a month for people to have ABC. All their money, as far as I understand, is ad-based.
So here's the thing.
So you're playing to fears.
Sure, but the fear is also predicated on the idea that I need to, what's a success, right? Success for a lot of these networks is that I'm going to make profit of XYZ, and this is where we fundamentally disagree, because I think that the problem is that money is the master we serve, rather than actually, even if you just look at entertainment, that entertainment is the thing we serve. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the problem to me. So if you're serving money, because a lot of these guys, they could take a risk and they might make a little bit less money, but they're still going to be all right. They're still going to be successful. They're still going to be putting, like, there's still going to be jobs in hands. You know who's not going to get as much money as they thought? The shareholders, which then they're going to bug out because they're not as rich as they wanted to be. They're going to be like maybe 2%, 1% rich. I'm asking for people to not care about money as much, which is a really almost impossible.
It's a really big ask for better television.
What's a really
big
ask for
people? Guys, I want you to change your way of living.
Well, no, but this is for me. This is how I feel about the world.
Sure, and there's, I agree with that.
We could keep talking, and a teaser for part two with Bernardo, which will come, I don't know, 6 to 8 months from now, or a year, who knows? But
when we're all living in Trump's America,
we'll be about robots and how they are going to kill us all. Because that was a phenomenal conversation I got to witness last time I was with these two gentlemen.
Well, that you should ask my wife to be a part of that.
Well, We haven't had a Jewish lady on our show.
She wouldn't do it. She don't like this kind of thing. She's not going to talk about herself.
She probably wouldn't have been okay with it being called The Jew is Fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. That and other quotes can be found in my book. No, I'm just kidding.
Bernardo, where can these lovely people, the two of you guys that have made it the hour with us?
My mom? Hola, mama. Well, the first thing I'd like to plug, if I can, is a really great friend of mine passed away recently. His name's Timmy Wood. He was an amazing comic, worked at UCB. And UCB has set up a fund in his honor that will help support comedians in New York. Basically, like, instead of having to be a barista, this fund will give them like 10 grand so that they can work on their fucking shit for 2 months, right? That's awesome. Just be an artist. And if you go to gofundme.com/Timmy Wood, you can give money. It's been really great. A lot of people have donated, and it's over 50 grand, I think, at this point. But keep donating, because all that money is going to letting artists be artists. So
T-I-M-M-Y.
W-O-O-D.
We'll tweet this out.
Great. Thank you. And then I have, I'm on Twitter, at Bernardo Cubria. I enjoy Twitter. I tweet a lot. I have a podcast about theater, off and on, a New York theater podcast. And I have a reading of my play through Ammunition Theater Company coming up soon. The play is called Neighbors, and it's about identity. It's basically about like the U.S. and Mexico and all that stuff.
We have to talk about you. Stop just saying that.
What?
Let people discover that.
I can't say that. Yeah, you're right.
And the podcast is called Off and On.
Uh-huh. A New York theater podcast. Got it. It's way too long of a name.
It's all good.
I just voted the best theater podcast.
By American Theater Magazine.
Yeah.
How many podcasts are on that list?
Oh, my God.
One and a half?
All the theater podcasts.
I actually feel like there would be a lot of theater
No, there's podcasts. Way too many fucking there's theater podcasts, fire, to be honest.
Really, yeah. Oh, way too God. Many, like two?
Dude, you don't even know. No, it's actually way too many.
Seriously, guys, I'm trying to end this because it's an hour. Okay.
All right.
Oh, right, an hour. Got it. Jesus.
Guys, thank you guys so much for listening. What do we say here? Oh, right. We
rate the podcast. Right. Review the podcast. Subscribe to the podcast. You are idiots. Give us 5 stars. I keep saying rate us wherever you want to. Then I read these. There's 2 3-star reviews. You're both morons. And I don't like you. I'm going to be honest. I don't like you.
Okay. Also, we have our Facebook post. A lot of you guys, if you haven't liked our Facebook page, please do it. And also, the post will have a little button that says share. Do that. We're still trying to build a community. I'd love for you guys to be a part of that. We're going to be back next week with some more dope content. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you next week.
God bless.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big.